following that. But this thing that I was reading about is probably the same one. The diameter of the solar, the black hole is from here, from the sun to the orbit of Neptune. Sounds like a huge thing. Thank you, Dick.
I never even thought about that one, the fact that as a black hole gets heavier and heavier, its so-called scorch-up radius, its radius of where you have to be moving at the speed of light to get away from it, that gets larger and larger. So 14 to 20 billion solar masses. You're saying, and I think you're right, that the black hole itself, which usually is the tiny object, would be as big as quite a few of the planets of our solar system's radius out from the sun. A really big object, and really big and heavy. Another thing that I was reading about NASA was investigating this week is that you guys have heard me say from time to time that the nice thing about our particular solar system is it's nice and simple because we have one single star in the center that you and I call sun. However, the majority of stars in this universe are binaries, not unaries. Our sun is a unary, but the binaries, trinaries, there's a hell of a lot of those out there. Okay? The nearest star to us, which is we always call Alpha Centauri or Proxima Centauri, really is, up until now, two separate stars, Alpha Centauri A and B. Well, they now know that there's an Alpha Centauri C. A and B go around each other, and I think the answer is something like 80 years, A and B go around each other. C is much further out, and it takes something like 100,000 years to make one orbit. So the closest star to us is a trinary star system. It's really a binary with another guy way out there, an outlier. And one of those two binary stars of Alpha Centauri, we now know has a planet going around it. And that planet is a hell of a lot closer than Mercury. It makes an orbit, and I think it's 3.8 days, and it makes an orbit around Alpha Centauri Bravo. So it's a, nothing is simple. So it's a trinary system with the alpha and the beta being the two primary stars, the big ones in close. And one of those in the binary has a real close-in planet, much, much closer than Mercury, going around once every 3.8 days. I wonder if you read about that one, Paul. So if that's the closest star to us, and if that system is that complicated, as we get better and better instrumentation in space, better telescopes like Kepler and others, and the those big radios, the infrared one that's going to be put up recently, all of a sudden I forgot the name of that one. I usually have a great big mark here where I keep, you know what I'm talking about, you'll give me the name. As we put better hardware in space, we're going to find out that these star systems with the planets going around them are in general a lot more complicated than we thought. WS2N, K2LAW, Red Bull.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, that's James Webb, named after one of the early administrators of NASA. He's one of the guys that were really instrumental in pushing the manned space program. I knew about the three stars for the Alpha Centauri system. I didn't hear about the planet going around one of them. Yeah, that's good news. That's pretty close. About a parsec away. Probably about a little over 4 light years away to Alpha Centauri. So that's pretty good. You've got other nearby stars. You've got the Bernard star. And then I think the one after that is Wolf 359. And then it goes out from there. And all of those are within, within 20 light years. So, that's pretty good. I'd like to see the day when you actually get a photograph or a picture of one of these planets. There's quite a couple of thousand of them, I guess, that they believe that they discovered so far. And James Webb might be able to do that in its infrared. You might be able to have enough resolution to actually see a planet going around one of these stars. Very hard to do. Brightness of the star really knocks it out. And then when the planet is so close, most of these Jupiter-sized planets are all within three, you know, they revolve around the star 3, 4, 5, 6 days. That's close. You know, they're within 33 million miles of the star. Very hard to see anything with that thing blaring, and you know, blaring sun. They say it's like, let me drop it. They say it's like taking a little firefly and putting it next to a bright headlight and trying to try to see a bug or something next to a bright headlight. Just can't do it. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
The way I've heard it stated, Paul, if a set of bright headlights are coming at you at nighttime with the high beam on, and you with your camera are looking directly into that headlight, are trying to read the words that are typed across the glass of the headlight, that's approximately the degree of difficulty of looking at a very bright star and trying to find this very dim thing called planet going around it when you're a zillion miles away from it. Very difficult process. A coronagraph is a kind of a telescope-like thing which, with apertures, with blocking objects inside, tries to block out the light of a very bright object, like the sun, and then try to see what's left over. And you can only take that so far before you run into a problem of the diffraction, the side lobes of the antenna pattern, so to speak, the diffraction lobes you get off a blocking object. Start again, re-blocking out the dim object that you're trying to look at. That's a little bit off to one side of the bright object. So you can only carry that so far. In the case of a total eclipse of the sun, let me drop. The total eclipse of the sun does such an extremely good job of acting as a coronagraph, because you've got this very large object called moon that's exactly the right diameter to choose the right solar eclipse. In other words, where the moon is the right distance in its apogee versus perigee. So you choose the right orbit of the moon, the right time of the year, the right year. The moon is a blocking object. It's got just the right diameter, blocks out the sun. It's a big object, very far away. So therefore, the side lobes, the diffraction lobes you get around the edge are a quarter of a million miles away from you. They don't give you any interference. So during a total solar eclipse, you get an extremely good view of what the corona of the sun really looks like. You're blocking out this bright light in the center of the sun. You're looking at everything that's left over. And if there was a dim planet in close to the sun, that would be the right time to view it. Well, to construct something like a total eclipse inside of a telescope-like piece of hardware that you launch into space is very difficult. But I think you're saying, let me drop. What I think you're saying, Paul, is that the James Webb Infrared Telescope, when it's launched, it's so nice and large, it's going to be in such a beautiful dark place in the sky, in the Lagrange point that's behind the Earth on the opposite side from the sun. So the sun will be the blockage so that the solar energy doesn't hit the back end of Kepler. Kepler has got these five consecutive heat shields, and at least during the time that it's got the cryogenics on board, where it's got the, very small number of degrees Kelvin of cooling of its detector, it's going to have huge sensitivity, huge resolution, in a very dark place in space, the ideal place, looking for things like what we're talking about. Should do a very good job. Let me drop and tell you one other funny thing. While I'm in the hospital, I'm trying to hear what Limebach sounds like, because under normal circumstances, my way of finding out what the world is doing is I listen to 60 Minutes on 60 Nights, on Sunday night, if the football game ends soon enough. I listen to Nightline many nights, occasionally read a newspaper, and find out what's going on Long Island. I listen to Limebach. And to listen to Limebach in that hospital was very difficult. Extremely, as if only a quarter of a microvolt of signal got there if I held the antenna in just the right spot. I tried walking around walls to try to go to the western end of the building, but I would have had to go through the psychiatric ward, the OBGYN ward, and they would have stopped me long before I got there. So, and I couldn't dwell there very long with a handy talkie. The good news is lots of the staff would ask me, what is that thing in your hand? What are you doing? And I got a chance to describe to them what is ham radio. But what I'm getting at is that that northern-facing window in this low-land building, and I'm in the fifth floor of it, looking through a screened window, and the upper part of it, lucky, wasn't screened. So with the Statue of Liberty way of holding the handy-talkie, or installing an antenna there, which I eventually did, I was able to get some kind of reception. Super weak. The next thing I was about to do is take as many coat hangers as I can find, and I was going to build a coat hanger Yagi antenna. Lucky for them, there were no coat hangers in the closet. I would have carried that out. It would have been another homely looking structure from their point of view, hanging from the window, aimed out the window, getting a reflection off some other object out just to the north, hopefully picking up more signal. Another thing I noticed that while being in the hospital is that what a tremendous number of people came in contact with me. I mean, we take all the people that I came in contact with at the emergency room who were starting IVs, putting in various antibiotics, measuring vitals, talking to me, discussing what they're going to do next, eventually moving me. And the place was so filled up that the first night I had to spend in the ER, they couldn't even find a bed for me. Once they got me into the right bedroom, you've now got people that are serving you food, other people that are taking the food trays away. You've got the day shift, the night shift, the graveyard shift. They're all giving you medications, giving you IVs, measuring vital signs, measuring temperature, pressure, talking to you, discussing what's going to happen next. Let me drop. The bottom line is I was there for 4 days, 72 hours. That's a portion of 4 days. I believe I came in contact with 50 human beings. And here's a hospital that has on a yearly basis more than 100,000 people that flow through that facility by way of the ER and outpatients and everything else. 100,000 sick people flow through that building. 50 of them, 50 of their staff and volunteers came in contact with me. They in turn come in contact with some significant portion of those other 100,000 people. Despite the fact that they do everything they can with mopping the place down, cleaning everything up every single day, you can see that no matter what they do to the sanitation, you've got thousands of sick people being brought into that building, spreading their diseases. Some of those people probably came from Asia, and they've got Ebola and all kinds of viruses and whatever, and one of the contaminations in that hospital, let me drop. One of the contaminations in that hospital was me. I had a discussion with a couple of physicians saying, I bet you guys have not heard about San Joaquin Valley, which is something that's very prevalent in the Mojave Desert of California where Edwards Air Force Base was, and I drove there. And I got a really wicked case of San Joaquin Valley fever one day. And I could tell that they hadn't heard about it. It's just something that doesn't exist on the East Coast. Well, those spores that you pick up from the Mojave Desert that give you that disease, almost everybody who lives there, you analyze their blood, and you've got the antibody in their blood against that spore. I'm an Eastern that went there. I didn't have that antibody, and I got sick as a dog for at least a week when I was there. And those spores that are in your body from that particular disease, you control them downrange, you build an antibody score, but you never completely eliminate them. A couple of years after I came home from the Mojave Desert, I had a flare-up of that disease a couple of years downrange. So here I am. You think I'm a nice, healthy person. Well, I'm bringing those spores, coccidioidomycosa, I'm bringing them into that hospital. I'm just one of the thousands of people. So what a brew. You know what I mean? What a mixture of those. You may have heard, let me drop, that 90,000 people per year in the United States die in hospitals because of errors. Errors, you know, wrong medication and diseases that they pick up in hospitals. So I guess it's a place you don't want to dwell there very long if you can help it. Somebody, I think there was KD2 AOC who wanted to make a comment. However, right now, I believe the 2585 input is not operational, so if he's able to get on 975-375, we can ask his question. So anybody who wants to try to get through at this time, give me your call letters and your name, K2RIW in the tech net.
KD2AOC.
And Dick, one other launch took place last week. I forgot to tell you about it.
Okay, yeah. AOC, we're going to pick up with you in a second. But first, let's finish up with Paul. Go right ahead, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, the other station. This will be quick. We've talked about this before, but this is the third mission of the X-37B. That's a military flight, top secret, actually. You don't know exactly what the elevation is of the flight or the inclination of the flight. They think it's somewhere around 40 degrees, but it's the one that is unmanned. It looks like a small space shuttle. It's got a lifting body style look to it. It's around 30 feet long, and it's essentially a spy spacecraft. It's got cargo doors that open up. The solar panels come out from that. That's how it gets its power, and it stays up there for about a year, and it'll come back and land on a runway. And the last two missions, it'll landed out in California, and this one, it's going to land in Florida about a year from now. So I want to bring you up to date. That happened, I believe, the 27th of, let's see, it was supposed to be the 27th, about a week ago. I think the flight took place. It was supposed to be the end of November the 27th. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
I thank you, Paul, for the information. Dennis, I'm going to pick up with you in a second. One other thing I wanted to mention is that Jim, I don't think, signed it tonight, KD2BHY. As you know, he's building what I'm going to call a tuna fish radio, tuna fish can radio. When Jim gets a chance to see the January issue 2013, the January issue of QST on the front cover, there's a whole bunch of homebrew projects, tuna fish can type radios. And one of them contains a beautiful picture of what the old-fashioned 365 picofarad air variable capacitor looks like with the right kind of wiring to it. You know, great big long wires going over to a coil, which at those frequencies, that's a perfectly good way of wiring things. So Jim has been asking us in the past, what does that capacitor look like and how do you hook it up? And so he's going to see it on the front cover of the January issue, the upcoming issue of QST magazine. Dennis, KD2AOC, go right ahead with your question or comment, K2LIW.
Thank you, Dick, and I hope Paul's going to stick around for this one. First, little comments. It's good to have you back. John was a good, fill-in, but it's good to have you back, Dick. Also, I'd like to send my sympathies to everybody in Newtown, Connecticut. I just think that's appropriate. Then let me go on to my question. I'm going to drop for a second. The question I have, you may think it's crazy, but I've been reading and seeing a lot of things on December 21st, 2012, that we're going to be entering into a band of highly charged particles, that there's going to be an alignment between, I think, three stars, so that there's going to be a lot of things going on that may even flip the magnetic poles of the Earth. Have you heard anything on that? Over.
Yeah, most people think that the Mayan calendar, which comes to an end and gets reset something like December 21, 2012, they think that's going to be the end of the Earth. When it comes to alignment of planets, alignment of stars and whatever, making a significant change in what we experience on Earth, I'm very skeptical of that, Dennis. Let me give you an example. If you made a scale model of our solar system, and in the old days we said it had 9 planets, and you make the scale model where the planets are the right distances, the right size, and the sun's the right size. You make that scale model, and you'll be amazed at what it indicates. First of all, the 4 inner planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, are the closely spaced planets. They're packed in real tight, per se, by comparison to the rest of them, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto. Very wide. planets, the rocky planets that are packed in real close. And now I'm going to make a scale model. And Mars is roughly half the size of Earth. You've heard me say this whole thing before, but some people think it's worth repeating. Mars is half the size of Earth, and if I'm trying to make a scale model of Mars and Earth, and I would need two round objects that are 2-to-1 in size, I could use a 50-cent piece representing the Earth and a dime representing Mars. Let me drop. And so the dime represents Mars, 50-cent piece represents Earth, and now I'm going to make the scale model the right distance that took place during the time that we sent the Curiosity to Mars. And the separation between those two is half a mile. So the densest portion of the solar system, built to scale, you'd lay a 50-cent piece down at the right distance from the sun, so to speak, and you'd have to put the dime representing Mars a half a mile further away. Obviously, in between, there's nothing but empty space, and that's the dense portion of the universe. So when we talk about alignment of planets, and now we start talking about the spacing between stars, which are much, much bigger than that, I'm having a great deal of belief, trouble believing, that anything significant is going to happen on spatial alignment, planetary alignment, or star alignment. The spacing between the stars is just such huge numbers. So what were they implying, Dennis, that these alignments are going to do? You did say reversing the magnetic field. I doubt it. The Earth, let me get up. The Earth's magnetic field is a function of the fact that we've got a molten iron core that rotates, and that generated a magnetic field. Mars maybe had a molten core at one time, but Mars is much smaller, has completely cooled off, doesn't have a molten core, doesn't have a rotating molten core, has essentially no magnetic field anymore. Our rotating core had a couple of very elaborate gyrations over thousands of years, and we do get a variation in magnetic field, an occasional reversal of that magnetic field. And by looking at all the past geologic records, you can find out how many mass extinctions the Earth has had, 5, and how many times the Earth's magnetic field has gone through reversals. And so, yes, the Earth is going to do that. And is it going to do it because a zillion miles away there is a planet and/or star that has certain alignment? I doubt it. I think what's going on 4,000 miles between below your feet at the core of this planet is what's really dominating that Earth's magnetic field. That's my guess and feeling on that one, Dennis. KD2AOC, K2LAW in a second.
Yeah, I do agree with part of that, but we've had numerous flips in the magnetic poles over the course of time. And I guess I was trying to aim this towards, you know, what happens to ham radio with this. But let me go one step further. We're not talking solar alignment. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a galactic alignment that is going to happen for the first time in the history of the universe, of the whole thing. So that's where I'm going with this. And we're also supposed to be entering or have entered already, which may be the reason why the radio waves have been screwed up, a charged particle dust band, which may... let me drop. Which may go on for a very long time. So what I'm trying to get to is it's not a solar alignment. That's, you know, that's one thing. We're talking about at least three stars. Sirius, I think there's Abbasaron, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, which is in the center, and one other besides our solar system. So it's really something much bigger than just a localized our solar system.
The Voyager spacecraft is out there at something like 120 astronomical units. If you measure the distance between Earth and Sun, and you use it as a yardstick, we call that an astronomical unit. Pluto is out there 39 astronomical units, and those two Voyager spacecraft are the furthest objects mankind has ever launched, highest speed, furthest objects, and they're out there something like 120 astronomical units. It takes, you know, one way for the signal to get out there is, I think, something like 10 hours, something like that, at the speed of light. They're really far out there. We know that the Voyager spacecraft are approximately at the point where they're going to be leaving the solar system, per se. That is to say, all these particles falling off from the sun. Let me drop.
And you're up to 17 hours now, Dick 1-1.
Thank you, Paul. 17 hours. Okay. So 17 hours one way. That's something like 120 astronomical units. That's really far out. These particles being boiled off by the sun that we call solar wind, we know that they eventually have to stop. And pretty soon, as you cross that threshold, leaving our solar system, you eventually get to the galactic wind as opposed to the solar wind. And they know that those particle detectors on the Voyager spacecraft will eventually see the solar wind particles stop and the galactic particles start as you cross over that threshold. That's what they've been expecting. And as you've been listening to those reports from NASA for the last 6 months or so, it ain't as simple as that. There's apparently some bubbles of solar wind going out there, depending on what each of one of those explosions on the sun, so to speak, your coronal mass expulsion, CMEs, depending on, they're like rifle shots. As the sun rotates once every 27 or 28 days, and it's got these bubbles of explosions going on the surface, great big bubbles of solar particles get launched. By the time they get way out there where Voyager is, they give you some funny disturbances, but they've been discovering that the solar wind out there, they expected it to stop, and it didn't. It just curves around at a right angle. In other words, it's going around the corner, so to speak, due to some local magnetic field or whatever. And the real galactic wind, I don't think they've seen it yet. You're probably a little bit closer to this than I am, Paul, but I think my reading is that they're surprised about they didn't see a sudden stop of solar wind and a sudden pickup of galactic wind. WS2N, for some further words on this, H-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Yeah, that was last week's topic, a little bit on that. We had talked about the, they're detecting, they've got magnetometers on board, and they're also detecting the magnetic direction. And they expect once they go through that one area, they call the magnetic highway, and enter intergalactic space, the magnetic poles will actually reverse. Talk about the poles, you know, I mean, what they're detecting now will actually go in the opposite direction. So they're looking for that, and Voyager 1 is furthest out, and they're expecting that to happen within 6 months, maybe, and maybe a year or so. But, they keep looking all the time. But they're starting to see, you know, a slight change in it. So, you know, that's about to happen. And then they'll say it's in there. It's left the solar system. Just want to go back to magnetic poles. On Earth, the poles are flipped here roughly every 400,000 years. It was a good article I read not too long ago about that. And every 400,000 years, you don't have a mass extinction. The dinosaurs don't get wiped out before that. You don't have extinction. One right after the other every time that happens. And let me drop it. And also every time they do shift, it takes centuries. You know, it's not like one day it switches over. So that knocked out theory is the magnetic pole reversal. And as far as the Mayan calendar goes, they figured out it was some kind of an error. And they were really talking about the year 3500. It was found in some hut in the Mayan area, and it was some kind of prediction of how long the rule of this one emperor, whoever it was going to last, you know. And meanwhile, I think it's a couple of hundred years later, that whole civilization was wiped out, so much for that. That whole theory went right out the window when this guy up in Boston, who studies this type of thing, investigated it. So, but back to you, Dick. WS2N on the Voyager. Yeah, you're right. I think it's 120. It's a little over 120 AU.
Paul, sorry, KDOC, KD2AOC. Paul, is there a galactic alignment occurring also at the same time? know, forget the Mayan calendar. Is that what's going to start to occur after the 21st? Over.
Remember reading something about a year or so ago about some kind of alignment between center of the galaxy and what was it? One of the nebulas or something. You know, so some kind of thing. But, you know, I mean, these things are so far apart that they have no gravitational influence. I mean, everything has gravity. You know, I mean, even the Earth has gravity at the old way at the other end of the universe, but, you know, some kind of a real force that affects anything. Now, that would be really impossible. But there is some kind of an alignment going on, and I don't recall what it was, but whatever it was, some kind of gravitational effect on it would be zero, as far as I'm concerned. Back you up, WS1.
This is KD2AOC again. I'm sorry, Dick. But, Paul, weren't there some things that punched holes through the rings of Saturn or something with Jupiter? That was unexplained. It was some sort of an energy burst. What I'm trying to get to is, you know, you talk about an alignment, but this is an alignment that's never happened in the history of the Earth. Number two, when you have many people on a line tugging, it's more than one. Number three, we're going through a charged particle band that may last for a very long time. And I guess what I'm trying to say is, I mean, yes, it's going to pull on all the cores of all the planets and everything else, and it's going to make them erupt. And let me drop for a second. And we have seen an uptick in earthquakes. We have seen sandy flood things, so that would make you think that maybe there was more of a pull on the tidal structure to make things flood further than we've ever seen. I mean, there's a lot of things at play here, and I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know, do you think that even radio, ham radio, is going to be effective if between the reversing of the poles, of all these stars, and all these other things are occurring at the same time? Over.
I would say they're all unrelated to one another, but, you know, ham radio is going to be affected over maybe the next couple hundred years as the poles might somewhat reverse. You know, you're going to have different auroras, and that's going to affect the HF communication, sometimes for the better and sometimes for the worse. But as far as anything penetrating the Saturn or Jupiter system, Jupiter does have rings, but I've never heard anything or heard of anything that has affected that whatsoever. The sun goes around the galaxy every 250 million years. You make one revolution. So since the Earth has been around 4 billion years, we've made roughly 16 revolutions. And I don't think anything bad has really happened. You do have an oscillation going on as we rotate in the Orion arm. They have all these different spirals coming off the galaxy. We actually oscillate up and down every 8,000 years. That might have an effect. You might come close to, but let me drop it. You might come close to another star, which might affect the Oort cloud, and you might have, at one point, you might have more comets coming into our solar system coming toward the sun. That might be an occurrence roughly every 8,000 years, but completely different. Nothing would be related to one another. Gamma ray bursts follow up billions of years away. maybe affecting maybe space travel or something, but nothing's going to change the tides or the weather of the Earth. I think you might have more of an effect of global warming directly here, around in our atmosphere, causing a problem, but nothing extraterrestrial. I guess back then at WS2-1.
KD2AOC. Well, yes, the Earth is going above and below the parallel line of the entire universe, galaxy, whatever you want to call it. And that's what causes the wobble. And like you said, there's an interim period where it changes back and forth. But we're also traveling in chasing the sun at 132 miles per second, which I believe is 486,000 miles an hour, while the sun is rushing in a certain direction. So this static theory about, planets following on a plane, is really not correct. It's more like a corkscrew, and we're flying through the solar system. But over.
Let me ask you this question, Dennis. I believe you're responding to one or two particular articles that you've seen on the subject you're now discussing. I wonder if you could send me an email or tell me where I can see that article so we can see it directly and read it directly and therefore get an interpretation. That's question number one. And question number two, you're listed as living in Kutchork, which I believe is North Shore, pretty far out. And you got a beautiful signal into this repeater. Are you running a good-sized Yagi with a lot of power aimed at this particular 975-375 repeater? How did you do it so well, Dennis? KD2AOC, K2IIW?
Well, that's funny, Dick. I got half of an old friend of yours, NY2NY, Jay Buscemi. And I'm actually on one of the highest points on the North Fork, and I'm running an old Cush Crab Ringo that he gave me off a mobile set, so I'm not doing anything really special. Over.
Fantastic. You may know that Jay Buscemi, NY2NY, you'll have a lot of fun looking at the January issue of QST Magazine. On page 20, Jay has a beautiful picture of his two automobiles, which both have an NY2NY license plate. And he had to go through hell to get those license plates because New York State had made the mistake of issuing that vanity plate to a non-ham. And he tried to get them to correct their error, and they wouldn't do it. So he got around that by requesting a vanity plate with NY2NY that has J-NY2NY for plate number one, and NY2NY-J for plate number two. And as I said, page 20 of QST Magazine, you're going to see that beautiful article by Jay, that little miniature article as to how he did that. You may or may not know that Jay Buscemi, NY2NY, the former K2OBS, was my college roommate at Pratt Institute way back in the dark ages. He and I on 432 megacycles go way back. And he is the major reason I'm a VHFer. In my freshman year at that school, I met him. I had been doing some 40-meter CW work. And he says, you don't know what you're missing on VHF. When he dropped, and he talked me into it. So, he with his help, you've got that beautiful antenna in Kutchog. And boy, you're doing well. And why do I not hear Jay on the TechNet once in a while? You ought to rib him a little bit. You ought to hear his great words. I believe he's one of the officials of the Peconic Amateur Radio Club. My guess is you went to his Christmas celebration a week or so ago. And good that my former roommate and you are close buddies. Fantastic. Let me pass it back to you for a couple of words on this one, Dennis. That's a small world. KD2AOC, K2LIW in the net.
Let me just say, Dick, that Jay only has good work for you, And yes, he has spoken about the times when you were roomies, and some of them were fairly funny, but I won't share them. I have seen the pictures of Jay's cars on QSD, and I actually sent them an email, and he said that I knew more than he did. So Jay's a good, he's just an all-around good person and excellent ham aficionado. Actually, he was my first contact, and he sent me a card. So, I mean, who sends them anymore, really? Over.
Fantastic. And by the way, Jay and I being roommates, we did come up with a pretty a good set of tall tales. We had a good ham station in our in the room that we shared together, a rental room. And so ham radio was definitely a part of our operation. We also did a mountain topping operation. We went to Vermont on 432 megacycles back in the day when that state was very hard to get to. Jay, me, and our other ham radio roommate, a guy named Dave King. So the Fortunas were single guys, ham radio operators, going to the same college together, and all these tall tales that you hear as to how we treated the female students at Scott Institute. Some of that is bragging, not all of it is true, Dennis. You gotta do a little bit of filtering of those stories. Some of it's true, though. We had a wild old time. Now, so when you get a chance, Dennis, do bring to my attention that article you're referring to. But let me show you something else that's going on with sizes and times here. Let me drop. And that is, we just got an indication from Paul that the magnetic field reverses something like once every 400,000 years, but the mass extinctions are unrelated, obviously, by the fact the last mass extinction was 65 million years ago. So the numbers really don't correlate. Earth's bobbing up and down in our galactic plane once every 8,000 years. But we go around our galaxy once every 250 million years. And when it comes to timing, let me show you something else funny going on. Rich, N2EO, brought to our attention that he had come to the conclusion a couple of weeks ago that when we find life on these other planets going around these other stars, which we will do eventually, let me drop up. He asked the question, would they look like us? And I think the answer is definitely not. For the conditions to be the same, very unlikely. And let me give you an example. Mankind on this planet, if I go back to the early fossil records, I could say there was a man-like animal roughly 3 million years ago. And to really look like man is roughly 1 million years. Okay, 3 million years ago in the evolution of all of the things on this planet, and by the way, 99% of all of the living animals, mostly plants and animals on this planet, are now extinct. 99% of anything that's ever been on this planet is now extinct. You're looking at the last 1%. It's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, and mankind is somewhere in the vicinity of 1 to 3 million years old. And that sounds like those are close numbers. Not really. If I took the 4.5 billion year lifetime of the Earth and compressed it into 1 4-hour day, I'm just readjusting the clock. 4.5 billion years, I've compressed it into a single 24-hour day. The 1 3 million years of mankind represents the last 20 seconds of that day. 23 hours and 40 seconds worth, mankind was not there. So if you were a space traveler, let me drop. You're a space traveler and you arrived at the Earth some during the other 23 hours and 23 hours and 40 seconds, and you take a snapshot of what's on Earth, you're going to see an entirely different group of plants and animals, and mankind will not be there. So us to come along and say that we're going to find another planet, bring around another star, and we're going to find things on it that look just like mankind. So all the conditions for that particular evolution to have taken place, I'm speaking non-spiritually here, so, and I know that's going to offend some people, but so the chances of that, those conditions to be just right, and we're looking at the right epoch in time where we catch mankind. We've had five major mass extinctions on this planet, and each one of those periods of time, you come and take a photograph and you say, okay, I see what's going on, I know what's going to be coming. Three mass extinctions downrange, we're going to have mankind. Not likely. So, as you can tell, when it comes to studying stars, planets, and whatever, no matter what you think you understand, you think you've got a solar system pinned down, you know how it works. As you discover more and more information, it's more and more complicated, and this is stranger than fiction. You can't write stuff like this. Sci-fi can't be quite this wild. So getting back to my original question now, Dennis, is there an easy way you can tell us the article you're reading that have caused you to ask these very interesting questions? KD2AOC, K2RIW.
KD2AOC. Actually, it was sent to me, and it's on YouTube. It was by a professor, and he said about doing this understandable segment, which lasted about approximately an hour and 10 minutes. And some of it's fanciful, but some of it's really, really interesting. And actually, I was actually surprised that some of the things that he was saying, and I never knew it. I was never taught it in any of the schools I ever attended. I got a bachelor's degree. It just was never there. So I think it was... I'm going to struggle to say this, but I think it was Mark Ock. But if you look up Mayan calendar 12/21/12, you'll probably come up with it. But it's Mark Ock or something like that. But it's really interesting, and he spent a long time putting this together. And it's besides the second half of it, it's a very lucid and very credible, as far as I'm concerned, approach to looking at some of these alignments that are occurring right now. Over.
Very fine, Dennis. There's darn many things you could find that branch off of many of these YouTube videos. So if you get a chance and you can just take that URL of that exact YouTube video, send it to me as an email, k2riw@arol.net. My call letters arol.net. I'll take a look at it. Jay and I both went to what we thought was an extremely fine electrical engineering school in New York City, way back in the dark ages of the early 60s. We go to a really good electrical engineering school that had a fairly high accreditation rating, just a little bit lower than the Brooklyn Poly at the time. I didn't go to Brooklyn Poly because they had a language requirement. That would have given me some grief because I wasn't language-oriented. What I'm getting at is the real good school teaching us electrical engineering, by my current standards, taught me almost nothing about antennas. My reason for existence, my raison d'etre these days, my consulting business, is mostly concerned with antenna design. And Jay and I think we know an awful lot about antennas, and none of that particular information came from that school. And it's not unique. The number of schools in the United States that do a real good job of teaching science of antenna design, let me drop. There's very few of them. Georgia Institute of Technology, maybe MIT, maybe Stanford, and maybe Berkeley. There, and maybe University of Virginia. Very few schools really teach the antenna science. And when it comes to wireless equipment, that's where it happens. That's where the rubber meets the road. You and I can design the most gold-plated transmitter and receiver with a zillion watts of power. If you don't connect it to a reasonable antenna, you're wasting your time. You're not going to radiate a radio signal, and you're not going to have wireless. So that's something that needs correcting. The way we teach electromagnetic theory needs a lot of improvement from my point of view. The professors only vaguely understand it, so we've got the blind leading the blind when it comes to that whole educational process. A bunch of opinions there, but you can see what it's based on. Alrighty. Did I skip anyone else that had a subject that we should be discussing tonight? Give me a call that is right now. I guess Wes is one of those. I guess I'll just go over to Wes. What research have you been doing lately, Wes, that's going to make us get rich quick? I'm having a little bit of fun with Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW on the TechNet. I just realized we've got a we've got a problem with. Right now, the machine, for a bunch of reasons, is aligned in a procedure by which 146.2585 does not get through, only 975375. And I know from your QTH in Queens to get all the way out there to Seldon is quite a haul. Unless you've got a Yagi aim to the east, it's going to be a difficult trip for you. So I think right now we don't have that other input working. And maybe a little bit downrange we will. Are there other people on frequency tonight? Particularly the Canadians, which we haven't heard from in a long time. And boy, those Canadians are a little luckier than we are. They don't have, from what I can tell, they don't have anywhere near the firearm problem that we seem to have here in the United States. The number of school shootings, for instance, and this last one in Connecticut, Newtown in Connecticut, is just out of sight. In our case, the genie is out of the bottle. All of those guns are in the population. Let me drop that for a minute and say a few words on this one.
N2RDV, comment.
K2WILD. In a second, N2RDV. We traffic here between with some people interpret as the right to bear arms, which was appropriate in our pioneering days, and is it appropriate today? Right now, the statistics will show you that something like 100,000 Americans per year experience a gunshot wound. 30,000 of per year die of those gunshot wounds. There's an awful lot of carnage taking place in the United States in firearms. And should we really have semi-automatic weapons, assault weapons being allowed in the population? Where in the case of Newtown, Connecticut, you talk to the guy who did the autopsy. Every one of those autopsies, every one of those children from age 5 to 6 contained 3 to 13 gunshot wounds per student done with an assault rifle. 3 to 13 shots per person, and because it's a semi-automatic weapon, he has to pull the trigger 3 to 13 times in succession, while aiming that weapon into that human being. That's a level of carnage, it's a level of, I don't know what the hell that is, but it's a degree of anger on that person is my speculation. It's just out of sight. How do we allow this? Should we continue to allow it? N2RDB, start up with your name, sir, and your comment on this one. It's got me a little bit upset. K2RDB, in a technet.
K2WILD. I'm going to call you about 10 minutes on the other frequency, 2585. Not realizing it wasn't working. There were a couple of things I wanted to say in reference to the alignment in the galaxy. I remember a similar conversation in the early 80s. And they were concerned that all seven planets were lining up in a row, and there were going to be tidal waves and earthquakes, and it was going to be the end of humanity. And then back in 97, a bunch of people committed suicide because they thought the aliens were behind that silly comet or whatever. And every few years, you have the Nostradamus nut jobs coming out and saying, well, this is it, folks. Let me let it drop for a moment.
Bernie has a message for you, Dick.
John, can you hear me? It looks like I'm being heard, right?
Yes.
Is Dick still there?
Yes, I am, Bernie. Take you while you go right ahead.
Okay, I was just, two things. One, if you get the email about the video on YouTube, please forward it to me and I'll put it in the Dropbox so everybody can view it. And I was just going to tell you that there are some 85L inputs on now.
That is what? Good to know, Bernie. Okay, so 2585 is now back in operation. And so, Tim, you're talking through 975-375. 2585 for the last hour or so has been inoperative, and we've been talking through the other input. You can now flip back to 2585 and talk to us from Mineola, Tim. And yes, Bernie, as soon as I find out that video from Dennis, 82 AOC, I'll send it to your Dropbox. And for those who don't know, quite often we will be discussing
some particular computer program, some particular YouTube video, some particular URL on the web. And we discuss those things on the internet. And in the past, people were felt like they're in the dark because we're having this private conversation about material they didn't know about. Bernie has, for the last 6 months or so, volunteered to act as a Dropbox so that any of this material that we're going to discuss on the TechNet, you go to Bernie's address, which is Hunt Family, K2IO, huntfamily.org, I think it is. You will therefore be able to find out what we're talking about. Give me a little bit more words. Correct me on this one, Bernie. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2LIW.
No problem, Dick. Anybody that would like access to the Dropbox for the TechNet, basically we've got at this point 6 or 8 months worth of every time there was some information to be shared, it's in there. Just drop me an email at Bernie, B-E-R-N-I-E, at huntfamily.com, or go to QRZ, I'm K2YO, and my email link works off of there. Drop me an email, say you want to be on the, you want to have access to the Dropbox, and I'll be glad to put you on it, K2YO.
Yeah, we're glad that Bernie has volunteered to do that. So that puts us all on the same page when we're discussing these esoteric, sometimes, pieces of material. The way of Bernie's Dropbox. Okay, now, Tim, let you finish your comment first, Tim. And to RDB, if I understand correctly, what I think you're saying is that in the past we thought the end of the world was coming. Y2K, for instance, when we turned over to the year 2000, we thought every computer on planet Earth was going to suddenly explode and all the aircraft are going to crash and all kinds of terrible things are going to happen. Now, because of the way the dating, the consecutive dating mechanism that was put with four operating digits in digital format onto our computers in the early days, and no one ever expected us to be using those pieces of software that many decades downrange, yes, the machine would get a little bit confused, and I think a whole lot of people anticipated that. And when it comes to the major databases of things like hospitals and insurance companies, they applied corrective action, and when the Y2K date occurred, or the very next year, whichever one they predicted, this great big disaster everyone was predicting didn't take place for a bunch of reasons. And so now we're talking about something even considerably more esoteric. The alignment of planets, the alignment of stars, our particular position in this particular arm of this particular galaxy, and the way we go around this galaxy once every 250 million years, bob up and down every 8,000 years and so on, we believe some really terrible things are going to happen. And yes, in the great scheme of things, over 4.5 billion years of this planet, some terrible things did happen. 5 mass extinctions did take place. But the number of years in between those mass extinctions is such that is it going to happen during our couple of seconds of that 24-hour clock that represents the whole epoch of planet Earth? Is it going to happen on December 21 of the year 2012? I'm a bit skeptical of that. And the planets are so widely spaced, I don't think so. But I think this is somewhat what you were also telling us about, Tim. N2RDB, to continue, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Thank you. Yes, this is N2RDB, and as I was saying before, every few years you get some event or something that happens that, or something that's expected to happen where all the doomsayers come out of the woodwork, and this is especially more common in years that end in zero. And I've been hearing all this talk about the Mayan calendar, and they just found some hidden cavern where they found that there was another wheel, and, people are going to get all worked up about this, and it's probably going to turn out to be nothing. Now, I did want to say something about the incident in